Okay, I'd like to call the House Resources Committee meeting today to order. It is April 3rd, 2024. We are in Capitol Room 124. We have a full committee present today, Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Baker, Representative Rauscher, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. We definitely have a quorum for to do business. I would like to recognize Executive Director Ruaro in the audience from ADA. Thank you for being here, Randy. And I'd also like to thank the staff, Zach, Justin, and Rose for helping us run the meeting today. I would remind everyone to please put your cell phones on silent. We have a pretty heavy agenda today, a lot to cover, so we'll get right to it. Three bills to discuss, HB 394, which is the RCA regulation of natural gas storage. This is our first hearing on that bill. House Bill 393, Cook Inlet Middle Earth Gas Royalties, again, the first hearing in House Resources. Then finally, House Bill 388, which is Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending, which is in its third hearing in House Resources. We will not be hearing House Bill 359 today. So the first subject today, House Bill 394, the RCA regulation of natural gas storage. I bring the bill before the committee. This is a House Resources Committee bill. This will be its first hearing. I will ask my staff, Trevor Jepson, to come up, put his name on the record, give us a presentation on House Bill 394, and go over the sectional. Before Mr. Jepson begins, I will read a sponsor statement for House Bill 394. House Bill 394 is aimed at enhancing the energy security of South Central Alaska by providing a clear regulatory framework for third-party natural gas storage. This bill was designed to establish a regulatory framework that not only encourages the expansion of natural gas and LNG storage facilities, but also ensures these critical pieces of energy infrastructure operate efficiently and remain economically viable. HB 394 provides for the RCA to have a clear oversight authority over natural gas and LNG storage facilities, which will bring stability and predictability to the sector and make it more attractive to operators and investors. HB 394 defines principles for the determination of just and reasonable rates, ensuring that operation costs, tax incentives, and fair market value of storage assets are all considered. This approach aims to foster fair pricing practices that benefit both consumers and businesses. This bill also introduces measures to protect sensitive financial information, mandating confidentiality for certain records. This move strikes a balance between protecting commercial sensitivities and fulfilling the need for regulatory transparency. Additionally, the bill recognizes the complexities of state and federal regulations by exempting LNG import facilities that are already regulated by the federal government from state oversight. Finally, HB 394 is a necessary piece of legislation if the state of Alaska wants to see third-party gas storage from the private sector. I urge my colleagues of the 33rd Legislature to join me in supporting this bill, which represents a decisive step forward towards reinforcing South Central Alaska's energy infrastructure and ensuring the well-being of our state. Okay, so with that, we also have AOGCC Commissioner Brett Huber, NSTAR President John Sims, and Director of Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, Derek Nottingham, on the line and available to take questions from the committee members. So can you hear me all right, Mr. Huber, Mr. Sims, and Mr. Nottingham?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Just John Sims, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. And finally, Mr. Nottingham. Got two out of three. Derek Nottingham, can you hear me? Okay, we'll keep trying when to get him hooked up. Okay, so
Chairman Kay.
Okay, Mr. Nottingham's there, so we have all three. Okay, thank you. And I'm also showing Mr. Robert Doyle with the RCA. Mr. Doyle, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, great. Thank you all four gentlemen for being with us. And now I'll turn it over to my chief of staff, Trevor Jepson, to make the presentation on House Bill 394.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the rest of the House Resources Committee for being here today to hear this bill presentation on HB 394 regarding the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or RCA, regulation of gas storage facilities. And I would just like to make a note that we only have Commissioner Doyle on the line till 1:30. So we're going to do a little bit of a quick intro here so committee members can have questions for Mr. Doyle. HB 394 was crafted to set the stage for and encourage third-party gas storage in Cook Inlet in light of projected gas production shortages. Currently, there's only one commercial gas storage facility in Cook Inlet, the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Alaska, or CINGSA, which is operated by NSTAR, which South Central is heavily dependent on and has a working storage capacity of 11 BCF. In order to increase storage volume for excess gas produced in the warmer summer months, which is needed for the colder winter months, and to be prepared for potential liquefied natural gas imports, our state needs to capitalize on other depleted reservoirs in Cook Inlet for storage and make sure that we regulate storage in a manner that will attract the private sector to engage in the market. The issue with having only one storage reservoir was highlighted earlier this year in February when CINGSA had production issues during a cold snap. Even if CINGSA had a larger gas storage capacity, we should still be focused on increasing gas storage both in terms of volume and individual storage units as a redundancy measure in case we have issues with CINGSA in the future. First, we'll go over the four depleted reservoirs in the state that are currently acting as active gas storage facilities in Cook Inlet. First, we have CINGSA, which was established in 2011, has an 11 BCF working volume, 18 BCF total storage capacity. We'll go over the definition of those two terms and the differences in the next slide. CINGSA is RCA regulated and operated by NSTAR. Next, we have Kenai Gas Pool 6, which was established in 2006. Currently has a 17 BCF working volume and a 50 BCF total storage capacity. Hillcorp is confident that that 50 BCF could be significantly higher if it was needed. Kenai Gas Pool 6 is not used as a commercial storage facility currently, and it's unregulated. Pretty Creek was established in 2005, also unregulated and operated by Hillcorp, with 3 BCF total storage capacity and 2.9 working volume. Finally, we have Swanson River, which is located on federal lands in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, established in 2001 with 3.4 BCF total storage capacity, 3 BCF working volume, and this one is unregulated, also operated by Hillcorp. So gas storage in depleted reservoirs can be summarized at a high level by the graphic on this slide, which was provided by the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas. Storage consists of injector wells powered by compressors and producer wells. At any given time, you have a certain amount of gas, referred to as cushion or pad gas, that has to remain in the reservoir in order to manage the flow of the, in order to maintain pressure and manage the flow rate of gas via the producer wells. The reservoir pressure drops too low, your flow rates will decrease to a level that doesn't meet peak demand. The maximum volume that can be produced is referred to as working gas, and inventory gas is the sum of the two. So just as an example, CINGSA has a full capacity of 18 BCF, but it's referred to as having 11 BCF storage capacity. That's the working gas. The 7 BCF needs to remain in there as the cushion or pad gas to make sure that we have adequate flow rates and reservoir pressure. Here we have a thorough summary put together by the DNR, which explains how the delineation of duties between the three state organizations which engage in gas storage activities breaks down. AOGCC manages the subsurface operations, such as injection volumes, well integrity tests, maximum pressure and injection volumes, and reviewing yearly performance reporting. Department of Natural Resources manages lease agreements and terms, ensures the terms are followed, and monitors gas injection and withdrawal cycles. Finally, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or RCA, ensures safe operation of facilities and regulates just and reasonable rates of gas storage, which are ultimately passed on to the consumer. They currently have the authority to regulate facilities with third-party storage. However, reforms to the regulatory framework, which HB 394 represents, are needed in order to expand storage facilities beyond our one commercial facility, which is SINGSA. So a quick overview of 394 clarifies the regulation of natural gas and liquefied natural gas storage operations under Chapter 5 of Title 42. It exempts LNG import facilities already regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to avoid dual regulation. It clarifies that fair market value costs related to gas storage will be considered when determining a just and reasonable rate under 4205, and it also creates confidentiality requirements related to financial statements of entities providing gas storage operations. With that, Chair McKay, we can go into the sectional, or because we're slightly short on time, maybe we want Commissioner Doyle to start his presentation.
Okay, it's probably a good idea to let Mr. Doyle give his presentation. Do we have his slides? Or we do. Okay.
Just 1 second.
Mr. Doyle, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine. And I'll turn over the presentation, the slides, to our staff member, Becky, and she'll present those. And then if you have any questions, I'm prepared to stand for them.
Okay, very well. You said Becky?
Yes, Becky Alvey.
Oh, yeah, Becky Alvey. Okay, I just want to get the name for the record. Becky Alvey. And Becky, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, Becky, your slides are up, and Mr. Jepson can advance them for you. And you're on the screen. Okay, there you are. Okay. Sorry about that. All right, Ms. Alvey, please begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Becky Alvey. I'm the Advisory Section Manager at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And Trevor, if you can move on to slide two, we'll just kind of talk a little bit about some of the changes that HB 394 presents for the commission. This adds a new subsection under our general powers, which would provide that we regulate natural gas storage and liquefied natural gas storage, including those facilities that are connected to pipelines, which were previously are currently exempt. This also amends AS 4205-381K by adding two subsections related to the cost to the utility of storing gas. And as you can see on the screen, for when we determine just and reasonable rates, which includes the fair market value of oil and gas fields, drilling rigs, production platforms, wells, and similar assets used for gas storage or liquefied natural gas storage, and a fair return on the fair market value of those assets, and costs related to dismantlement, removal, and restoration of the gas storage facility or liquefied natural gas storage facility. And then this bill also defines gas storage used in AS 4205-381K to have the same meaning as AS 3105-032. Next slide, please. This bill will add a new section to Article 5 and a new subsection to Article 6 to classify records as confidential of gas storage facilities, and providing that the RCA hold these records confidential unless we determine that disclosure to another state or federal agency is necessary for the RCA to complete its duties. It also amends the exemption found at AS 4205-711Q, eliminating the exemption from AS 4205 for a natural gas storage facility that is part of a pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier or a natural gas pipeline facility operated by a natural gas pipeline carrier. And then, as mentioned before, this bill adds an exemption for liquefied natural gas import facilities that are under the jurisdiction of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. Next slide, please. HB 394 adds a new subsection to AS 4206-140 to provide that the RCA will regulate natural gas storage and liquid natural gas storage related to facilities attached to pipeline carriers. It adds a new subsection in AS 4206-370, similar to the subsection in AS 4205 regarding costs, and then it amends some definitions. And it adds, again, the subsection about confidential records. Next slide, please. This should look at our impacts of the passage of this bill. The RCA is going to need to process certificate applications for pipeline carriers and natural gas pipeline carriers with storage facilities that are part of an in-state pipeline facility operated by the carrier. We'll need to review and approve periodic tariff filings by these carriers to implement or revise terms and rates of natural gas storage service, including charges for reserving or utilizing capacity in storage facilities or for injecting or withdrawing stored natural gas or liquefied natural gas. We'll also need to review and approve tariff filings by regulated electric and natural gas utilities requesting to recover the costs of using the storage facilities through their cost of power or gas cost adjustment. Next slide, please. Further, we may need to look at our application forms to revise those and our regulations. We will also need to consider whether clarification by regulation is necessary to implement the cost recovery provisions. And finally, we'll need to consider whether additional regulations to address the confidentiality of records is necessary. And with that, I'm on the line for questions, and so is Chairman Doyle.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Alvey. I'd like to just ask at the outset, it looks to me like the RCA would support House Bill 394. Is that a true statement?
This is Robert Doyle, and I can speak for myself on my own behalf, but not for the entire RCA because we haven't taken a public vote on it. But yes, I support this. I think this is a good part of the solution. We also need to get production up as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Doyle. So I have questions. I'm not sure who was first. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, possibly to Commissioner Doyle. Or maybe Becky, I'm not sure. I'm looking at slide two, and it's also on slide four, that the value, the fair market value of oil and gas fields would be allowable as a cost that can be recovered and regulated. I'm just not quite sure how, I understand drilling rigs, production platforms, wells, et cetera, for a storage facility, but what role does the fair market value of the oil and gas fields from which the gas would be drawn, how does that figure in setting the rates? How'd you do that?
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle. Basically, as you take a look at all of the investments that would go into a facility like Sinks, and my assumption is that this would be very similar because we'd want to have a level playing field between all these storage facilities, is that you would take a look at those investments, you'd take a look at depreciation values, and that would all be a piece of the revenue requirements as you take a look at all that. Just to remind folks, though, in terms of the gas contracts that utilities are signing, we don't negotiate those. We approve them. We review them and approve them, but we don't negotiate them. So, and no one regulates the wellhead price of natural gas. And so that's just something that the parties in the negotiations are going to have to address.
Good. Follow up, Representative Sadler.
Sure, follow up from the chair, Mr. Doyle. So the value of the oil and gas field, and I presume there's a nexus between these fields and the gas that's stored. How far does, because, you know, pores connect and so forth, how do you determine the value of gas fields, presumably gas, that are contributing to the cost that's recoverable?
Okay, through the chair, this is Robert Doyle. Basically, as you take a look at that, for example, I'll use the two new wells that Sinks is going to be putting in between now and November 15th. I mean, you would take a look at that investment. They would have to get a return on their investment. You would also depreciate that. It's just part of the overall revenue requirements of what it takes to operate the field and what it takes to get a reasonable return on your investment as the operator of those fields. So that would go through a whole hearing process. We would have dockets set up. The parties would come forward. They'd all get due process. We would review the facts under the policy set by statute and carry that forward. A lot of it's going to depend on the statute and the policy you all set, and it's going to also consider what the regulations that come out of that.
Real sure
follow-up, Representative Sadler.
Just to clarify, so I think you described the wells for Sinksa, which I think are just injection wells. So are we talking about gas fields that are producing gas that is stored in a facility? Is that what we're speaking of, oil and gas fields here?
My guess is right now, just to let you know, I believe that also BRU, which is currently operated in a partnership 3366, I think, is the percentage shares with Chugach and Hill Corp. Yes, that's an operating field. I think they're taking a look at the possibility of using that for some storage. I don't have all those details. I think maybe DNR would be better suited in terms of how an operating field, how that would be segregated out, the operating field that's still in operation, and whether it could be used for storage or not. That's probably beyond what the RCA would get involved with.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Doyle. Let me clarify a couple things. The acronym BRU is Beluga River Unit. And then, Representative Sadler, the two wells that SINCS plans on drilling are producing wells, not injectors. Quite sure of that. Okay. Representative Mears to Mr. Doyle.
Thank you, through the chair. The confidentiality part of this bill really stands out to me, since RCA deals with the detailed financial ins and outs of utilities throughout the state. How is this different in this circumstance? Isn't confidentiality either protected in other ways or just completely open books for other utilities?
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle. We do routinely deal with confidentiality requests and petitions that come from the parties. And anytime somebody feels that there's a, we call it the mighty might standard, that there's a possibility that there would be some damage that could happen to by divulging information that's proprietary, that we grant those kind of confidentiality requests. In this case, I just believe that this legislation wants to raise that issue and put it in as a specific piece of the statute, and we would carry out whatever the mandates are of that statute. Becky may have something she wants to add to that. Becky?
Through the chair, this is Becky Alvey.
Yep, go ahead, Ms. Right, Alvey.
Additionally, currently our statutes and our regulations provide that records to the commission are public unless they are made confidential. This statute, this bill would specifically make the records that came in for financials for the pipeline confidential right off the bat. Otherwise, generally, our regulations provide that records are public.
Follow up, Representative Mears.
Yes, through the chair. So it sounds like there's already a mechanism in place for confidentiality when requested. Is this unusual to have a blanket confidentiality for an entire regulated section or utility or service?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, we have in our regulation certain items that come in that are already deemed confidential. But that's through our regulation. I'd have to look a little bit further through our statutes to see if there's anything else that we specifically call out in statute to be confidential. But overall, yes, it is a little different that these records would be confidential from the get-go.
Okay. Any other questions on the presentation by the RCA? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I did notice in the sectional that we kind of briefly looked at but didn't get into, but if the RCA could indulge this question, does this affect any current or future operations on Knock Globe, specifically at Point Thompson, where they currently transport gas condensate? I'm not sure if that's a RCA or a Mr. Jepson question.
Representative Baker, through the chair. No, for the record, Trevor Jeff, so no, it does not. That's still regulated under the Pipeline Act, which is Chapter 6 of Title 42.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will read the sectional. I just want to make sure we do it in the right order here, but because of the respect for the time of Mr. Doyle. Representative Sadler had a question.
Yeah. Thank you. If I can, through the chair, on slide 2, Ms. Commissioner Doyle, I want to make sure and hang some meat on the bones of this language that talks about storage furnished by operating a natural gas storage facility that's part of a pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier. or a natural gas pipeline facility operated by a natural gas pipeline carrier. Can you hang some meat on those and tell me, like, what kinds, who that might mean, some examples of what that might be? There's a lot of natural gas facility pipelines. Help me understand what that language means, please.
I would have to do more.
Maybe Mr. Jepson could answer that more clearly, because...
Yeah, for the record, Trevor.
Through the chair, I agree.
Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. I apologize, Representative Zadler, through the chair. Could you repeat the question?
I'm looking at slide two, the first paragraph. It just speaks about storage furnished by different facilities, different entities. You know, a natural gas storage facility that's part of a pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier. That's just a lot of wheels within wheels. Just help me understand what that might look like or what that envisions.
Yeah, Representative Zadler, through the chair. What this bill does is it brings what would currently be regulated under the Pipeline Act, that exact same language, which is currently exempted from the RCA. The Pipeline Act is Chapter 6 of Title 42, and it brings it back under the RCA under Chapter 5. So the carve-out there, I know that kind of a lot of words there too, but the carve-out there is essentially the function is that storage facilities, including those that are related to pipeline carriers, would be regulated under the RCA. And that's currently regulated under the Pipeline Act. So that's the carve out there to clarify in the bill.
Thank you. I'm half answered, but I'll talk to you offline to get the more clarity. Thanks.
I do have a question that's holding from Representative Rauscher, but we have to go back to the previous slide deck. So, Representative Mears, is your question on this slide deck? Okay, yes, let's go to Representative Mears for this slide deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that we're just about out of time with the commissioner, so if we need to take this question and deal with it another time, I actually have two. One is, my understanding of FERC is that they wouldn't be dealing with rate settings, so I'm not sure that there would be an overlap between the imported LNG and what FERC does and what the RCA does. So I'd like to have a larger discussion about that. And then also a larger discussion on what is how is fair market rate determined in such a constrained marketplace? So I think those are larger discussions that we might have not enough time for today.
Well, Mr. Doyle, can you possibly finish up with those two questions before you have to leave?
I'll give it my best shot. Regardless of whether the production is coming from current fields like Hillcorp or BRU, the negotiated agreements for LNG and the fair market price there would be set by those parties that negotiate those agreements, not by the regulation. And we would be reviewing them to approve them based upon the overall regulations it set in terms of making sure that they're fair and justifiable rates based upon the revenue requirements outlined, based upon all of the financial data that we have presented in those hearings, the actual data. In terms, I don't know if I'm, I do think that it probably would require some additional talk and some additional debate to make sure that we're understanding it. But our role, again, is not to negotiate, it's to approve the final rates that are going to be charged by the utilities to the customers.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think that the fair market value of the gas, I'm thinking, Mr. Sims, would you like to address that with NSTAR?
On how you sure. Arrive? Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Sims, for the record, president of NSTAR and SINGSA, the storage facility that was currently referenced. So the fair market value or the LNG cost that's being discussed here, and whether or not it's regulated by FERC or RCA, I think is a very good question from the perspective of I don't believe the utilities are in a position yet today to know whether or not that's going to be infrastructure that's owned by a utility or whether or not it's something akin to a Hillcorp where we just buy gas for a certain quantity over a certain period of time at a certain MCF rate. So, if it's proposed to be a utility type asset where, for example, NSTAR is purchasing over a certain time frame or not just purchasing its services, then I think ultimately my preference would be that it is regulated by the RCA for transparency purposes. If it's sort of a full suite where we're just acquiring on a per MCF cost basis those molecules and that's all kind of wrapped in, then perhaps it just needs to be regulated by FERC. To be honest, I think it's a little early to determine whether or not it should be regulated by the RCA or just by FERC because of the sort of uncertainty around that facility and how it's going to be utilized and leveraged by the utilities. I will say this, there is the potential for some significant monopolistic power that asset could have, but that's to be determined. So I hope I answered that, Mr. Chair. That's my thoughts here at this point.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sims. So you have a comment, Mr. Jepson?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. Just to address Representative Muir's question earlier about why the FERC carve-out in there is somewhat necessary. Currently, because the Kiski plant would be dealing with interstate commerce, their liquefied natural gas storage is regulated under FERC, and so that carve-out was put in there because without it, it would also be regulated by the RCA. So they would be double regulated without including that section of the bill, and the bill is seeking to avoid that double regulation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jepson. I'm holding Representative Rauscher's question. Can we go back to the previous slide deck? Do you know which one it was, George?
Probably the first or second.
First or second slide.
Oh, sorry, wrong one.
Yeah. So here, Representative Rauscher.
Through the chair, the slide says that we're aimed at encouraging third-party gas storage to increase gas storage capability in the Cook Inlet as setting the tone for this piece of legislation. I was under the impression that it had been an accepted fact almost that we are moving toward a need by the utilities who recognize a situation where storage will come into play. And this bill provides a framework for that to happen. We're not trying to do it oppositely. Am I wrong here?
Mr. Jepson?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. Vice Chair Rauscher, through the chair, I'm somewhat confused on the question, but I'll just address the language where we said aimed at encouraging third-party gas storage. As we've seen on the slide where we showed the multiple gas storage facilities operating in the state, three of those are operated by the private industry, by the private sector. So when we say encouraged, what we're saying is this bill was crafted in a way that companies and the private sector would allow their storage to be used for third-party gas storage. If we pass a bill that doesn't address concerns by the private sector, there's no guarantee they'll open that storage up for third-party gas storage for utilities. If I didn't answer the question, feel free to ask again.
Follow-up, I think you just restated what I said.
Well, what we're trying to do here, we're not really trying to impact CINGSA. We're trying to ask the private sector in Cook Inlet to provide storage, additional gas storage, to give us more capacity to handle a shortage like we had last winter. And the private sector does have that capability, and this bill is tailored to encourage the private sector to participate in that gas storage capability. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It occurs to me, I'm kind of still thinking in terms of CINGSA as the model to store production from Cook Inlet. I guess the question obviously is, would this bill provide for RCA regulation of storage facilities that might accept gas that came in for a floating regasification unit? I'm not sure to what function in the entire gas storage chain these storage facilities would serve. Would they serve just gas produced from Cook Inlet, or would they be potential storage area for imported gas?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, yes, they would also apply to imported gas, liquefied natural gas produced in Cook Inlet and liquefied natural gas.
Thank you.
which is important to note because, you know, the earliest we've seen for LNG import capability is 2030, which is 6 years from now. But planning ahead for the future, if we did import LNG and you had a large tanker come in, you'd want to be able to unload it. And you'd have to have the capacity to unload it because they don't just wait around. They want to unload and then get on their way. So this bill looks into the future as well, into that possibility. So what I'd like to do is have Mr. Jepson read the sectional so we can get that crossed off the list, if that's all right. So can you do that for us, Mr. Jepson, the sectional for HB 394?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. So starting with Section 1, this adds new subsections to 4205-141, which includes the regulation of natural gas storage and liquefied natural gas storage under the jurisdiction of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, including storage facilities operated by a pipeline carrier or part of a pipeline facility. And that's the language Representative Sadler was referencing earlier. The reason why that's specifically entered in there is because under current regulation, all that, any pipeline carrier or pipeline facility is regulated under Chapter 6 of the Pipeline Act. Section 2 amends 425-381K, which further specifies cost considerations. Currently, it just mentions tax reductions and royalties paid, but we also want to enter in fair market value of equipment used and costs expended. Section 3 provides a definition of gas storage facility. Section 4 adds a new section to 4205, which addresses the confidentiality of records related to the finances of gas storage facilities. And I also like to clarify, earlier Representative Mears referred to that as blanket immunity, but there's actually carve-outs in there that if the commission deems it necessary to disclose the financial information to the state or to the federal government, that's allowed if the commission decides to do so. Section 5 amends AS 4205-711Q to limit the exemption from RCA Gas Storage Regulatory Authority to gas storage associated with the North Slope Natural Gas Pipeline Facility, and that would addresses Representative Baker's question. That's still a carve-out. That's still going to be regulated under Chapter 6, which is the Pipeline Act. It won't affect any North Slope gas pipeline. Section 6 adds a new subsection to 4205-711, which specifies an exemption from RCA Gas Storage Regulatory Authority for a liquefied natural gas import facility that's already under the jurisdiction of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. Section 7 adds a new subsection to AS 4206-140, and that's that Chapter 6, the Pipeline Act, which clarifies RCA regulation of natural gas and liquefied natural gas storage under 4205, even if it's operated by a pipeline carrier or part of a pipeline facility. Section 8 is conforming language, which adds a new section to AS 4206-370, which specifies cost considerations related to pipeline carriers and determining just and reasonable rates. So that adds that same language about fair market value rates. Section 9, amends AS 4206-445A, which adds a new subsection G to the exceptions related to the public inspection of records and possession of the commission. Section 10 is that reference subsection G, which specifies the confidentiality of records held by the commission related to the finances of pipeline carriers who are storing natural gas. Section 11 is a conforming change, repealing two definitions, 4205-990-10B and 4205-990-11D, which exempt natural gas and liquefied natural gas storage, which is incidental to the production or sale of natural gas to third-party customers from 4205. And Section 12 provides for an immediate effective date.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jepson. And I believe that Representative McCabe had a question from earlier.
I do. So I'm interested to know, as long as we're planning for the future, and we are here in HB 50 at some point, this week or next week, I think, if this would apply to carbon sequestration storage.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, The DNR might be a little better suited to answer that. I don't know if we would have dual carbon sequestration storage as well as natural gas storage. That would seem to be somewhat of a headache to me. So I think they'd probably separate them and designate as one or the other. But if Division of Oil and Gas Director Derek Nottingham would like to take a stab at that.
So maybe just a follow-up clarification of my question, if that's all right. So
Representative McCabe.
What I'm interested to know is if the incentives would be the same for somebody to sequester carbon in their reservoir that they have instead of natural gas.
Yeah, Representative McCabe, it seems like that would be pretty impractical because CO2 is considered a waste product, and I don't believe that you would intentionally mix CO2 in with your natural gas that you were planning to later put into the market. But maybe Mr. Nottingham, could you comment on that for us?
Yeah, Chair McKay. I believe the answer to the question is the carbon capture and sequestration will be separate from this. It will be handled under completely different regulatory authorities from our standpoint, leasing, those kind of things, as well as from the AOGCC's standpoint in terms of the types of wells and the assurance that's required to enable any existing or future reservoir to act as an underground storage facility.
Chairman, I believe that's correct. You'd have two. The CCUS operation would be a completely different reservoir, totally different well designs because you have to account for the corrosion. So the two operations would be completely separate.
So to be clear, again, I'm not talking about putting CO2 in a natural gas reservoir. What I'm talking about is we are giving the natural gas guys a break here, right? We're trying to incentivize them. If somebody else has a hole in the ground that they don't want to store natural gas in, but they might want to store CO2 in, are we going to give them the same break? That's what I'm talking about. Totally separate. I get that.
Okay.
You can't put CO2 in a natural gas well. Totally on board with that. But what if somebody has a hole in the ground and there's a coal plant that wants to come in, and they want to have the same break to sequester their carbon in the hole in the ground that they own, that would ostensibly be ours, the state of Alaska's, because it's a resource, right? Are we going to give them the same break? That's the question.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, so when I think about carbon sequestration as compared to this third-party natural gas storage, carbon sequestration is not economical without that federal government tax subsidy, whereas this third-party natural gas storage is economical. The RCA would be regulating it and determining that fair market value for the gas storage rate. So it'd be hard for me to, or hard for really anyone to kind of see what would be the smarter economic decision. But they would be done in completely different processes. Do you want to be regulated for third-party storage and have that RCA rate determined, or do you want to use your reservoir to go after that 45Q tax credit? I don't know the economics comparatively for any given reservoir.
With respect, it's HB 394 is, I don't think it's correct to describe it as a break. It's purely setting up the regulatory framework so that gas can be stored on a temporary basis until it's needed in the colder weather months. The only economic component that I see in HB 394 is the sale of gas when it gets produced in Cook Inlet or when it comes in from a LNG tanker of some sort. And that transaction is basically made from the party that's producing the gas or delivering the gas to the utility, which I think in this case would be NSTAR. So the only financial transaction in the whole bill is between whoever owns the gas when it gets delivered, whether from the Cook Inlet field or from the tanker, and it goes to NSTAR would take possession of it. There's no break. There's no tax break. There's no discount or anything there in that transaction. We're just enabling that to happen. And I guess I'd ask Mr. Sims, did what I just described, is that accurate to how you would see this with NSTAR?
Through the chair, this is John Sims. Yeah, I don't see any sort of financial break or incentive from that perspective. This is, as I understand it, a regulatory framework for third-party storage. So I think you summed it up pretty fairly.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. The chair, I'm not quite sure who to ask this question of. We've lost the commissioner, but just a question on terminology here. It's referenced a couple times in the sectional. I'd like to ask the distinction between a pipeline carrier and a pipeline facility. My assumption is that a pipeline facility is the actual, you know, steel pipe, compressors, treatment facilities, that kind of thing. And the carrier is either the owner of that pipeline facility or the someone who's shipping gas through on contract. So if somebody could clarify for me what the terminology pipeline carrier and pipeline facility imply.
Representative Sadler for the chair, that is also my understanding. I could pull up the statute book and get the exact definitions, but Ms. Alvey, if you're on the line and you want to confirm or follow up with Representative Sadler.
Ms. Alvey?
Through the chair, this is Becky Alvey. So our statute in AS 4206 defines pipeline and pipeline facility versus the pipeline carrier. The pipeline carrier is the owner, including any corporations organized under the laws of the U.S. or any other state or any pipeline, as the term is defined in the section, or of any interest in it, or any person, including corporations organized under the laws of the United States or any state, authorized to construct or to extend pipeline facilities. And then pipeline facility means all the facilities of the total system of pipe, whether owned or operated by a pipeline carrier under a contract, agreement, or lease in this state used by a pipeline carrier for transportation, for hire, and as a common carrier of oil, gas, coal, or other mineral slurry for delivery, storage, or further transportation, and including all pipe, pump, and compressor stations, station equipment, and all other facilities used or necessary for an integral line to pipe to effectuate the transportation from point to point, excluding, however, gas processing plants, treaters, and separators.
Representative Sadler, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Whoosh. So just to clarify, so the pipeline, the facility is the pipeline, the carrier is the owner of the pipeline, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes.
Right on.
Thank you. The pipeline carrier is the mover, is the entity, and the pipeline is the facility.
Right on. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? And I, Ms. Alvey, could you please extend my appreciation to Commissioner Doyle for his earlier participation? I forgot to thank him before he left.
Chair McKay, I will pass that along.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just like a follow-up statement, if I might. I absolutely...
The question.
Just on questions.
I thought you had a question.
Nope.
Okay, proceed with your question.
I just wanted to say a wrap-up statement in support of the bill and its purpose. So I am understanding from the work that we've been doing and from the industry that storage is an important component of what we need to have in place, not just what instances with South Central getting to the edge of our capacity this winter, but also the ability to, basically, this is our storage. This is our ability to utilize multiple forms of energy in the South Central region. And I'm looking forward to putting in place things that make that more system more robust.
Thank you, Representative Mears, for that. One more comment from Mr. Jepson.
Chair McKay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify for the record that if under this bill, the third-party gas storage would be available to any utility who wanted to purchase it. It wouldn't just be NSTAR. It could be MEA, Chugach. So I just wanted to clarify that it would be open to any utility.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Huber, Mr. Sims, Mr. Nottingham, or Ms. Alvey, do you have any closing comments you'd like to make on this bill before we move forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is John Sims. Just want to reiterate the importance and criticality of storage for the short-term, mid-term, and long-term planning of the utilities. You know, most of the language in this bill is a policy call and a policy decision. Happy to hear Chairman Doyle's support of it and his understanding of the criticality of this asset. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sims. We're glad to have you with us today. Any other comments from the...
Mr. Chairman, this is Brett Huber from the OGCC.
Yes, Mr. Huber, please go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know, from our agency's perspective, we would continue to regulate the wells, whether they be producers or injectors. We'd continue to do injection orders, whether this bill passed or didn't pass. Storage facilities are available in Cook Inlet now. As we view this bill, it merely states that if the storage facility is being utilized to sell to the utility, that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska should be the regulating body. So we don't see any other impact to our agency, and we appreciate the chance to be online today, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Huber. Anyone else on the line want closing comment? All right, hearing none, I just would like to say that I want to thank the committee for your attention. It's a very important bill. The way we've looked at Cook Inlet gas, the gas situation at Cook Inlet, there's things we can do like rather immediately. Then there's short-term, medium-term, and long-term things that we can do. This is an immediate action that the legislature and the state government can take to protect the rail belt from cold snaps in the winter. And I'm really, really proud to bring it forward, and I really appreciate your support. And are there any final questions? Okay, so I would like to, we will now be taking public testimony. So I now open public testimony on HB 394. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on 394? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone on the line that would like to testify? Okay, seeing none. Then I will close public testimony on HB 394. We'll be setting an amendment deadline for tomorrow, April 4th at 4 p.m., and I will set the bill aside. And I thank you, everyone, for your kind attention. We'll take just a brief at ease while we get ready to set up for the next bill. Okay, back on the record here at House Resources, we're now going to move to House Bill 393, the Cook Inlet Middle Earth Gas Royalties Bill. I bring the bill before the committee. This is a House Resources Committee bill. This will be the bill's first hearing. I will now ask my staff, Trevor Jepson, to come forward, and I'll read the sponsor statement first, as I did before with the other one. So House Bill 393, Cook Inlet Middle Earth Gas Royalties. This is the sponsor statement. In the coming years, South Central Alaska faces a critical challenge, a projected shortage and ever-increasing decline in Cook Inlet gas production. This looming shortage poses a significant threat to the energy security of our state, with the potential to lead to drastic increases in energy prices for the residents and businesses of South Central Alaska. The prospect of diminishing in-state gas supplies and a reliance on LNG imports not only threatens our economic stability, but also our way of life. Due to the nature of this issue, bold and decisive action is required. House Bill 393 makes a significant change to the Cook Inlet royalty structure based on the idea that the inlet is not attracting enough investment dollars and activity for development and exploration drilling. At this critical juncture, royalties on Cook Inlet gas, which decrease drilling activity, increase the cost of gas, or lead to costly LNG imports, represent a tax on South Central ratepayers, in addition to jeopardizing the energy security of our state. This legislation seeks to address the anticipated gas production shortfall by decreasing royalty rates on new wells for gas used by Alaskans to 0%, with the goal of fostering an environment which will lead to increased drilling and exploration activities in the Cook Inlet region. This bill also reduces the base royalty on wells currently producing to 5%, which will extend the life of those wells, leading to more gas production. House Bill 393 extends incentives to Middle Earth and allows drilling and development costs to be deducted against royalty burdens. The rationale behind HB 93 is straightforward. By enhancing project economics, we can attract more investment into natural gas exploration and production. This increased investment will not only mitigate the risk of a gas shortage, but also has the potential to stabilize energy prices for South Central Alaskans. HB 393 is an acknowledgement of the critical role that affordable and reliable energy plays in our lives and a recognition of the need for immediate action to secure our energy future. I urge my colleagues in the 33rd Alaska State Legislature to join me in supporting HB 393. I now ask Mr. Jepson to come forward and give us a presentation on HB 393 and go over the sectional analysis. We still have, do we have anybody online? I wanted to keep Nottingham online. They all went? Okay, maybe we can get Mr. Nottingham back.
Sure. Chair McKay.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Sure, I'm still here. This is Derek Nottingham.
Okay, Mr. Nottingham's still on the line. Is there anyone else on the line? Okay, you're the only one, Derek, so if we have any hard questions, you're going to get all of them. Okay. Mr. Jepson, would you please begin your presentation and go over the sectional?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. Thank you, Chair McKay, and the rest of the House Resources Committee members for being here today to hear this introductory bill presentation on HB 393 dealing with Cook Inlet Middle Earth gas royalties. And I'd also like to thank the committee for their patience, as a lot of these slides are going to look very familiar. A lot of the content is very familiar to a presentation Ed King and myself gave about a month and a half ago. We felt it was pertinent to get the same information on the record for this particular bill due to the nature of it. So first we'll start off with an overview of the problem. Declining gas production from Cook Inlet is forecasted to lead to a shortage of supply in the coming decades, from the 70 BCF standard that South Central Alaska needs from Cook Inlet to heat for heat and electricity of its residents. That is referenced by the horizontal blue line in this graph put together by the Department of Natural Resources. The blue portion of the individual bar graphs represent proved developed reserves, which are proved river reserves that can be expected to be recovered through existing wells and facilities by existing operating methods. The orange portion represents incremental proved undeveloped reserves, which are gas reserves that are expected to be recovered from new wells on undrilled acreage or from existing wells where a major expenditure is required for recompletion. We could see the aforementioned shortage first start to impact Alaskans as early as 2027.
And while it's unlikely Alaska is going to go cold and dark, if the low-cost energy we receive from Cook Inlet is replaced from high-cost imported LNG, the effects will be felt across the entire state, not just South Central Alaska. The shortage won't happen overnight. It'll set in over a period of roughly 15 to 20 years. However, if gas prices double, triple, or increase even more in the coming years, it can pose an existential threat to the state as we currently know it. Our state will likely lose population, as Alaska will be a less viable place to live due to significant increases in the cost of living from energy costs, resulting in a downward pressure on in-migration and an upward pressure on out-migration. Our state is already grappling with retention rates in all sorts of industries, and continuously increasing energy costs is likely to exacerbate this trend. In addition to the impact on residents, we could see government costs balloon as well, and that budgetary pressure will also spread to municipalities and boroughs via fuel costs and potentially shrinking tax bases. Now, we've seen significant interest in Juneau at addressing this projected Cook Inlet shortfall, and the legislature has tools at its disposal to do so, or attempt to do so. Royalty modifications are the most immediate and impactful tool at the legislature's disposal, and it's crucial to pass a significant royalty relief package this session. HB 93 provides one of the most aggressive royalty relief packages the state could adopt. Before we continue the bill presentation, we'll go over some polling data, which was conducted by Dittman Research this last summer. Among the South Central public, there is a high level of support for state incentives for private companies and utilities to pursue projects to ensure energy deliverability at around 60%. There is similar support for creating financial incentives for oil and gas companies to find and produce more Cook Inlet gas. HB 393 responds to that high level of support for financial incentives regarding Cook Inlet gas production. The aggressive nature of this royalty relief package is based on the idea that all gas produced in Cook Inlet is used by Alaskans, and disincentivizing production with high royalties that drive up price or leave in-state gas in the ground, leading to a dependence on costly imported LNG, represents a tax on Alaskans. In the previous slide regarding polling data, the most popular answer for avoiding LNG imports was that we are a resource state and we just need to go get the gas. This slide provides a little bit more background on Cook Inlet reserves from a hypothetical standpoint, which is not wholly unique to Cook Inlet. To be clear, these aren't precisely representative volumes and prices, but this is a tool to understand at a high level what gas volumes and production prices roughly look like going forward. Proven and easily accessible gas reserves are the least expensive to produce and thus the least expensive to the consumer. As we move to the right, we get into proven reserves that are still in need of development, which further drives up the cost. As we move even further to the right and to the undiscovered economically viable and undiscovered technically recoverable, we see a very high price, which would likely be competitive with LNG imports. However, the good news is that we still have hundreds of BCFs approved, developed, and discovered undeveloped gas reserves to the DNR, according to the DNR. And if we introduce changes to royalty structures, the net cost to the producers and thus the pass-through cost to the consumer is reduced, further dropping the estimated economical gas price of each block of gas and increasing project economics. The risk we run by not going far enough on a royalty relief package is that we won't have the desired effects and the state will see reduced revenues without a significant increase in gas development activities. When evaluating energy policy and the situation our state finds itself in, there's three primary considerations we should look at. The first is whether the policy is aimed at the short term or the long term, as Chair McKay referenced earlier. And in some cases, the policies can be aimed at both. Next is deciding what level of risk is acceptable to the state. If we're looking at higher costs of gas, such as importing LNG, that'll be a lower risk option, as we already have the capability to store natural gas and depleted reservoirs, and there's just some regulatory kinks we need to work out. It's highly likely that we can be ready to import LNG in the coming years with relatively low risk to the state from a policy perspective. Options that are of immediate higher risk to the state that impact state revenue, such as HB 93, which would be foregoing royalties on new gas wells, are aimed at lower cost energy for residents in the form of Cook Inlet gas. Oh, sorry, there's another bullet point here. And finally, we should consider how policies interact with one another and whether or not they complement one another. As highlighted on this slide, HB393 represents a higher risk option in the short term, which would result in immediate decrease in royalty revenues to the state with the goal of increasing Cook Inlet gas production and development, and thus the supply of low-cost energy for residents for years to come. This bill would also work in conjunction with other House Resources Committee bills to further increase project economics and make investment in Cook Inlet more attractive. So now we'll do a broad overview at the look at the potential fiscal impact of 393 with regards to a decrease in Cook Inlet royalties and compare that to the potential increase to ratepayers if LNG imports are as expensive as many reliable sources such as NSTAR and the Alaska Energy Authority are predicting. The table here shows a summary of the state revenues from FY20 to FY23 in regards to royalties and taxes relating to oil and gas. And as we can see, we make billions a year from the North Slope compared to tens of millions of year to from the Cook Inlet. And that when we say tens of millions, we're looking at least for this segment of time, $45 to $60 million per year. It is important to note that if we do nothing on royalty relief, we're already going to see decreasing Cook Inlet royalties over the next few decades as the production drops towards zero. Now we're going to look at what South Central utility revenues are, which represents the ratepayer cost. Last year, they made roughly $1 billion. NSTAR's roughly $250 million came from gas sales, and 70 to 80% of the other South Central utilities revenue came from gas-powered electricity. So if we see these prices double, triple, or go even higher as we move away from Cook Inlet gas, then we would expect that revenue that comes directly from ratepayers to somewhere in the same range, double, triple, maybe not quite as much as we bring more renewables online. But even on the lower end of that, we're looking at a potential increase in hundreds of millions of dollars. And if you contrast that with the potential loss of $40 to $60 million in Cook Inlet royalty revenue, the risk appears to be worth the potential reward. Now, Cook Inlet royalty revenue has a ceiling, it's that $40 to $60 million, whereas the increase to the ratepayer has a much wider range of what that dollar amount could look like. Based on the lack of interest in the Cook Inlet sedimentary basin, which are reflected in recent lease sales, the market is sending Alaska a clear message. The current tax and royalty structure is not ideal for investment. We can get upset about it, but at the end of the day, it's our problem and we owe it to the people of Alaska to address the problem. The rates of return on gas are significantly lower than oil. When companies make investment decisions with what is always limited capital, they evaluate projects based on economic factors and rates of return. By significantly reducing royalties, we're boosting the rates of returns and the economics of projects up, thereby making them more viable. All of a sudden, the economics of potential projects start to pencil out, and we can see investment flow into them. We look at modifying taxes and royalties, we need to think about what the state wants to incentivize specifically. By reducing taxes and royalties on new gas, we're wanting to incentivize production from new reservoirs. However, reducing royalties on already producing reservoirs would also increase project economics for increased drilling activity. To try and maximize the number of new wells, the state could cut royalties on all gas from new wells in Cook Inlet going forward, which HB 393 represents. When we decrease taxes and royalties on wells in production, we're extending the life of the wells. In the oil and gas industry, wells eventually reach a certain period where the flow rates are low enough that the cost of operations for a producing well are higher than the value of the gas that's being produced. At that point in time, the well is shut in and production stops. As such, decreasing royalties on wells in production will also increase gas supply by keeping late-in-life wells on production longer. This is also a policy in HB 393. And the final major policy in 393 is to not assess royalties until payout, which is the recuperation of costs for oil and gas development in Cook Inlet in Middle Earth, which is defined as south of 68 degrees latitude. By allowing investors or companies to recoup their costs quicker, this is another way to boost the rate of return by acknowledging the time value of money. So, broad overview, the changes in the royalty structure for Cook Inlet is 0% for gas produced from new wells drilled starting in FY25, 5% for oil produced from new wells drilled starting in FY25, and 5% on oil and gas produced from wells drilled prior to FY25. So this would kick in and give automatic royalty relief to wells already on production. And those the new wells drilled on leases would drop down to 0 and 5% for gas and oil, respectively. The bill also allows capital expenditures associated with development of oil and gas to be deducted from a royalty burden. That excludes the North Slope. And the bill requires the commissioner to enter into lease negotiations to comply with these terms. If you want, we can go into the sectional, or if there's any questions before we do the sectional.
Let's go ahead and get the sectional out of the way, then we can check that box. Thank you, Mr. Jepson.
Okay. So, Section 1 amends 3805-180F, which allows for an exception for the new subsection.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Jepson. An exception from what, please?
So, if 3805-180F, one second.
Glad we catch that.
We didn't get very far into the.
Yeah, one second.
It's a bit cryptic.
So 3805-180 is the commissioner may well progress. I believe I might need the statute book to see exactly what 05-180 is. So 3805-180 is adding for that exception MM. And then Section 2 defines the Section MM. So it has to do with what the terms of the oil and gas leases are.
I'm sorry, just real clear language to allow an exemption from what?
It will require the commissioner to issue oil and gas leases according to MM, which changes the lease terms.
I'm really sorry. An exemption from what, please?
Well, you said you have to look.
If we're making reference to allowing exemption, I just want to know what the exemption is from.
Okay, Rep. Sadler, can we hold that? We'll document that question and we'll come back to it. I think Mr. Nottingham might be able to answer it online, but maybe we could get through the sectional and then sure. And then we'll get on that for you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you.
So Section 2 is adding that new subsection MM to 3805-180. Which states for leases issued for property in the state, excluding land north of 68 degrees north latitude. The royalty share to the state may not exceed zero if you're recovering costs associated with the development of oil and gas produced from a well drilled on or after July 1st, 2024. And that's where the Middle Earth portion of the bill comes into play. It's not just Cook Inlet. It's also onshore south of the North Slope. Section 3 adds uncodified law regarding transition to comply with the changes in royalty rates, so that would force the commissioner to re-enter into lease agreements to abide by these changes in royalty rates. And Section 4 provides for an effective date of July 1st, 2024.
Okay, that completes the discussion of the sectional. Now, let's go to Representative Sadler's question. As I promised, and I hope I'm not making him answer his own question. Mr. Nottingham, do you understand the question here on Section 1?
Chair McKay, I believe I do, but that is subject to you guys' opinion when I answer it. What I believe the exception is for new leases, that they would be exempted from the minimum royalty of 12.5%. Does that make sense?
Very clear.
Okay. Thank you for your patience, Representative Zeller. Like I said, I hope you didn't have to look up the answer to your own question, but I'll start doing that more. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hardly know where to begin with this, but I will keep this short. This bill is a giveaway with no accountability or even promises of new gas forever. We in this committee, I think, need justification for how this would save consumers in utility rates. That's something I asked for the last time we looked at royalty. And I think that is something we absolutely need to be going over. What are the potential savings for utility customers? it is what we're saying that we're doing here. So what are the numbers to justify it?
Okay, thank you, Representative Mears. I would not characterize it as a giveaway, and I would not say that we could ever promise anything. We passed legislation to incentivize the private sector to do things we would like them to do, but I cannot promise. No one can promise what the private sector will do or not do. We just put it out there, and then, you know, we have conversations. We believe that they will act on this, but I can never promise it in on the record or anywhere else. Mr. Jepson, can we talk about what we believe will happen if energy rates were to double or triple? I guess at the raw material end of the supply chain, what will happen to folks' heating and electrical bills in the rail belt? We must have some idea what's going to happen. And I wish Mr. Sims was still on the line. Maybe we can get him back. But please, maybe you can answer.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay, it's a very rough calculation based on that slide we had earlier. What we have available to us is the royalty revenues to the state, which is that $40 to $60 million from Cook Inlet. And then we have the revenues of the South Central Utilities. And if we look at a doubling in price from utility gas for heat and electricity, that's just a straight pass-through cost to the consumer. So with those revenues would likely be in the range of doubling. Now, that could increase 75%, 25%. Either way, you're looking at a lot larger dollar amount than just that $40 to $60 million cap at a very rough calculation. Now, to your point that this doesn't guarantee new gas or new investment, that's completely correct. We acknowledge that there is risk associated with this. We don't have very many producers in Cook Inlet. There's not very much interest in Cook Inlet. So when we look at changing these royalty rates, we're not just trying to give away to current producers. We're actually trying to actively bring new producers to the region and have new companies evaluate Cook Inlet. Once again, we can't guarantee that. This is just an idea. It's a tool that the state has. And I Representative McKay believes it is a potential solution for the Cook Inlet issue to address some of those issues.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess in response to Representative Mears' question, yes, it's fair to ask the question of what's going to be the effect, what would be the effect of this legislation on the state's bottom line, their royalty take. About 14 years ago, the legislature passed the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, which provided for a tax holiday. Again, there was no guarantee, but the reduction of taxes in this basin is what has allowed us to have continued production for the last 10, 14 years. So again, no promises, but those are some of the handles that we have on the market. So we can lower the royalty share, make it more advantageous financially to invest in production from Cook Inlet, our backyard. And it's a question, it's a policy call for us to see if we think that the give is worth the get.
And I mean, Representative Mears, it's an excellent question. And believe me, I wish we didn't even have to talk about it. But we have to because, you know, the free market that we all believe in and love is not responding. When I talk, low-cost energy is a foundation of our economy. This is so important. This isn't naming a bridge or, you know, declaring a month for some special thing. This is part of the core base of our economy, low-cost energy. If energy prices increase noticeably, that's really bad for a lot of things. If you think about it, I wish the free market would take care of this, but it's not. Our administration sent the governor and several executives from the administration went to Energy Week in Houston. It's the biggest energy convention in the world. And there was nobody that came up to our guys and said, we're coming to Alaska. We want to drill and produce gas in Cook Inlet. So, and it's not really, we talk about Cook Inlet. We use the word market. We use the word market, but it's not really a free market at all. It's an isolated cell of activity. Cook Inlet's, I've said this before, but I'm putting it on the record for the public. It's a very mature field. It's kind of barely hanging on. It's isolated. Remember that we're projecting that we can't take external LNG for 6 more years. So we're isolated. We're not really connected to a market. And this is not Oklahoma. It's not Louisiana. It's not Texas, where you have hundreds of rigs, hundreds of operators, and you can sell gas through the Henry Hub to anywhere in America at any given moment. We have this limited market, which is the rail belt, which takes 70 BCF a year, and that's it. No, nothing more, nothing less. And I tried to think about an analogy. It's like the Fred Meyers and the cars and the Safeways. They can only sell so much milk in the rail belt, right? Because there's only so many people, and they're limited on what they can sell. There's nowhere else to go. If you have a grocery store in Oklahoma, you can expand into Kansas, Arkansas, Colorado, Texas. You can expand your market. But our gas producers in Cook Inlet, they don't have that optionality. So they have to meet that 70 BCF. So we're not a real market. I would love it if we could let the free market take care of itself, but it's not happening, and I don't believe it will happen, and we can't be wrong. We can't just sit and do nothing and wait and hope that the free market takes care of itself. We heard from an economist recently who wanted us to do just that. And I thought about it a lot. We thought about it, talked about it a lot. And I can't figure out how doing nothing and just waiting is very risky. Because if we're wrong and nothing happens, if nobody starts drilling, then we've made a wrong choice and then we're further behind. So I just wanted to make those comments. We have very few
royalties.
We have very, very few levers that we can pull on this, and royalties is one of them. Okay, back on the record. Let's see. Do we have any other questions before I take public testimony? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, if Director Nottingham is still on the phone, I guess I might have a question for him. And the question would be through the chair, Mr. Director Nottingham. The fiscal note from your division is indeterminate, but my question would be, it would appear that there's going to be some additional analysis and accounting functions that this will require, but I don't see any of those expenses reflected in the fiscal note. Am I making a wrong assumption that is it true that there will be no additional cost for analysis and accounting, or that those costs are included in the indeterminacy of the fiscal note?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, We do believe that we have the manpower, the staff to do the accounting as it pertains to capital cost recovery and the application of, you know, the differing royalties. I think the staff is very capable of handling these things. The capital recovery portion of the bill is very, we see it very similar to MPSL accounting. And so it's something that we have the expertise on the team to handle. And the indeterminate status has really nothing to do with that aspect. The people portion of it, it's more just the uncertainty in what the actual outcomes would be of the bill.
Okay, you're setting yourself up for a lot of work, but it's all good.
Okay, Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to follow up from my previous question that I still think through the chair, to Mr. Jepson and to you, Mr. Chair, that there's a lot of unanswered questions on the impact utilities, and a rough verbal is very insufficient on what the potential economic impact would be to consumers in South Central and statewide as we're looking at PCE. Thank you.
I would say, Representative Mears, that there will be significant impact if energy prices increase rather dramatically. Now, that's my opinion. Maybe that's not your opinion, but that's my opinion. So there we are. Any other questions before I do public testimony? Representative McCabe.
If you don't mind, so first off, the free market is already obliterated because we're taking money up. We're a government. We're taxing this. So the free market is... That's not even really a player right here. What we're saying is we want to get back to the free market by removing some of the tax, which is going to maybe increase the availability of gas. You can smirk all you want, but the gas is going away. That's a fact. So the impact to the people in South Central is they will actually have gas. Maybe it will be more expensive. Who knows? Because it's a finite, that's a study of economics. Is a study of a finite resource. Gas is a finite resource. It's going away. We're trying to incentivize people to come in. We're not trying to decrease the rates. We're just trying to get more gas. That's what this is designed for. So the whole discussion about rates and the cost to consumers are going to, it's going to be an increased cost anyways, unless we get more gas. If we can get enough gas, if we can find enough gas, if we can incentivize enough people to come here and provide enough gas, then the consumers won't be affected. But right now, they are going to be affected soon.
Okay, I'd like to do public testimony. So I hereby open public testimony on HB 393. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone on the line? Seeing none, then I will close public testimony on HB 393. Are there any further questions?
Chair McCabe, just to add a follow-up to
Mr. Jepson.
Representative McCabe said, and also to Representative Mears about the loss of revenues and the giveaways, that if we believe the projections, we're already going to have close to no Cook Inlet gas royalty money within 15 to 20 years. So, I mean, potentially putting a stop to that early and having cheap, affordable gas, that's, once again, that's kind of the risk calculation we have to look at. Thank you, Chair McKay.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Director Nottingham, again, as our chairman said, Cook Inlet is kind of a unique basin. There's some interesting special market forces operating here, but is there any, you know, oil and gas is a big business. There's sure been a lot of research. Is there any research or evidence in what I'll call the literature to give some kind of prediction as to how reductions in royalty by 1%, 2%, you know, 5%, 10% affect production? I can't understand that some smart economist, an oil and gas economist, hasn't looked at that. Do you know of any studies that might show the correlation between royalty rates and investment?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this is Derek Nottingham, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. I don't have a study that comes like right to the top of my mind, but yes, I mean, in general, there's quite a bit of literature and experience out there that that indicates that, you know, royalty reduction, lower fiscal regime does incentivize new activity in a basin and new oil and gas production. I think that's fairly well documented around the world, but we can dig up some literature for the commission if necessary.
Thank you. Through the chair, I know you have some smart people in the commercial section, so maybe that might be a question to put to them. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no other further questions, I'll set an amendment deadline for tomorrow, April 4th at 4 p.m., and set the bill aside. And now we'll move to item 3, House Bill 388, Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending. Bring the bill before the committee. This is a House Resources Committee bill. This will be the bill's third hearing in House Resources, and we need to adopt a new CS. So, Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Yeah, briefly, please.
Brief at ease. Back on the record, and thank you, Representative Rauscher. Do you have a motion?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 383 from Resources, also referred to as 33-LS1237-7.
Hearing no
objection. I'm sorry, backflash you.
Oh, okay.
Brief at ease.
House Bill 388. Eddie's. Okay, we're back on the record, and Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Rauscher, would you please restate the motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I restate the motion. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 388 out of Resources, also referred to as 33-LS1237-R.
Okay, without objection, the committee substitute for House Bill 388 Resources, also referred to as 33-LS1237-R, has been adopted as the working document. Okay. I will have my staff, Trevor Jepson, come forward and present the summary of changes for the new committee substitute. We have multiple ADIA employees available to answer questions, including Executive Director Randy Ruaro in the room. Randy? And I'm told that we should have Special Counsel Mark Davis on the line and Deputy Director Brandon Brzezinski on the line as well to answer questions. So why don't you do the summary of changes, Mr. Jepson, please?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. Section 1 of the new CS is a new section which conforms the Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending Fund to current ADIA dividend policy. Previous versions of the bill did not allow for that dividend, which is anywhere from 25 to 50% of the net income of the Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending Fund. Section 2 is a new section which would allow for the subsidiaries, the creation of subsidiaries under ADA to handle these reserve-based lending projects. Once again, that's done to allow more flexibility in case ADA wants to potentially sell one of these subsidiary companies. It also allows a level of protection from them in case something goes belly up. Section 3 amends Section 1 of 33 LS 1237/U. That was relating to reporting requirements that ADA would present in their report to the legislature. It removes the projected rate of return for the projects, as that's looked at as more sensitive financial information, and also it removes the ADA recommendation on whether to pursue the projects. And that was done because we don't want to put we don't want to put the emphasis on ADA to make these decisions, because we recognize that potentially there will be low rates of return on these projects, and it's up to the legislature to decide whether or not they want to fund them. Section 4 amends Section 2 of 33-LS1237/U to conform 4488-850A with other ADA investment funds, allowing flexibility regarding the transfer of funds into and out of the account instead of the previous version of the bill, which just designated the fund consisting solely of appropriations to the legislature. Now, this will prevent potentially money just being parked there, not being able to be moved, and also not allowing ADA to transfer money in if they identify a reserve-based lending project that they want to pursue with their own funds. Section 5 is the same as Section 3 in LS1237/U, and Section 6 is also the same, and that is the immediate effective date. And that is the end of the summary of changes, Chair McKay. Thank you.
Okay, I think it would be helpful for the committee. We've got about 15 more minutes. I don't want to use up all the time if we don't need to, but I think it would be helpful to just review what this bill, the intent of this bill in a couple of sentences, is to set up a fund within ADA to invest in oil and gas development projects that the legislature might see a need to incentivize. But Mr. Jepson, could you give us a recap of what the bill does?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. Chair McKay, that is correct. The bill was drafted to set up a specific designated fund for Cook Inlet reserve-based lending, which are projects where the loans are made based on the amount of gas reserves. So the value of the loan based on the size of the reserves in the ground. And this was done because, like we've talked about multiple times today, Cook Inlet is a very odd market where it has a cap on the amount of gas that can actually be sold. So because you can't sell all the gas you produce at any given time, that has impacts on how quickly you can sell it, making the projects less profitable. So for instance, the Cosmopolitan field, which is sitting on at least 200 BCF of proven reserves, I mean, if that was in the Gulf Coast, that would have been developed a while ago. But these very high costs associated with these big development projects, and then also you can't sell the gas as fast as you want to, that leads to a big hamper on the project economics. So to, once again, long story short, to sum it up here, Chair McKay, this bill was designed to set up this fund under ADA to allow them to invest in Cook Inlet gas projects, which may not pencil out according to current ADA investment standards, but they might pencil out when we calculate the impact on the states of not producing the gas and the value of having the cheap gas available to residents. Thank you, Chair McKay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jepson. And let the record show that Representative Baker has rejoined us. So what I'd like to emphasize, this bill does not commit the state or the legislature to appropriating any money whatsoever. It just sets up the regulatory framework for that to happen if at a future date the legislature decides we want to do project A, it'll cost this much money, here's the appropriation to do it, and it allows ADA to manage that investment from that point forward. Is that correct, Ms. Jepson?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. Yes, that is correct. And also, I don't know if I mentioned in that summary, but there's a reporting requirement on the bill. So if the bill were to pass this year, we wouldn't imagine it to be funded, but we would imagine ADA would come back at the beginning of next legislative session with projects that they've looked into in the interim and present them to the legislature.
So before I take Representative McCabe's question, I'd like to invite Executive Director Ruaro to come to the table and be prepared to answer a question if need be. So just please put your name on the record and your affiliation, Mr. Ruaro, please.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Ruaro, R-U-A-R-O. I'm the Executive Director for ADA.
Okay, Representative McCabe has a question.
Thanks. So, Mr. Jepson, you probably know this off the top of your head. How many, you said 200 BCF in the kitchen lights or in Cosmopolitan? Which one?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, right now the estimate is 200 BCF of proven reserves in Cosmopolitan, which is an estimate.
Okay, and follow-up?
Follow-up, Rep. McCabe.
So what I'm trying to get to here for the public, we also have kitchen lights, and of course, Hillcorp has some fields, right? So end of the day, what are the proven reserves right now in Cook Inlet? The last time I saw them, I believe the Hillcorp president for Alaska lined them out, and it was 10 years. Is that, I mean, maybe you could total them up for me, and we're using 70 BCF a year, so Cosmopolitan is worth about 2.8 years with proven reserves.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, I believe the DNR number is 800 BCF of proven reserves in Cook Inlet. If Director Nottingham is on the line, maybe you could confirm that for us.
Yeah, Director Nottingham, can you answer that question? The proven reserves in Cook Inlet remaining to be produced that are proven?
Oh, Chair McKay, I'm relatively confident it's 800 BCF, which does pencil out to about 10 years, which Representative McKay referenced.
10 to 12 years supply.
So follow-up?
Follow-up, Rep. McKay.
So this bill and the previous bill is to give us some tools to go forward. One is to incentivize people, and the other is to say this bill, particular bill, and maybe Mr. Ruaro is better equipped to answer that, is to say, here's the incentive. Oh, and if you want to take advantage of our loan program, here's a loan program, and it's to help the free market, if you will, or to help producers or drillers to come to Alaska and find a way, a path forward to produce more, to find more gas for us, South Central, for our energy needs. That'd be a fair statement.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, that is correct. All these House Resources Committee bills that the Chair McKay has introduced work together to try and provide an alternate pathway and improve project economics, whether that's in the form of loaning money to projects that can attract private capital or lowering royalty rates to increase the rate of return regarding time value of money, or the jackup rig credit. They're all penciled in to kind of work together and allow different options for producers.
Thanks.
And I should point out that this particular bill, 388, is a lending bill. They would have to pay back ADA, Randy. They would have to pay it back. So this is not a tax credit program like we did years ago where money was basically issued to operators to drill wells. This is this more specific loan program. I'd like to hear from Executive Director Ruaro if you'd like to give us your comments on the bill, and we'd like to hear your opinions.
Sure, I can do that, Chair, members of the committee. So ADA has broad discretion to enter into contracts and agreements under its organic authority in 4488.080, I think it's A11 and some other statutes. So we have broad authority. At the same time, over the decades, I think since 1961, when the first precursor to ADA was formed, the legislature has seen fit, I think, maybe two dozen times to go ahead and pass a bill that provides a specific financing tool similar to this, where they're wanting to highlight the importance of this tool and to bring attention to it and to give ADA some more specific authority to make some investments and loans. And so in the version R that it's as it's written now, it provides another tool in the toolbox for ADA, and ADA is supports the amendments that are made in version R.
Okay, I had Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions, if I may, through the chair to Director, Commissioner Randy.
Yeah.
First off, the two fiscal notes, one from ADA, one from AEA, one says that the fund shall be established in AEA, that is the Alaska Energy Authority, and the other one says the fund shall be established in ADA. Can you resolve the seeming contradiction for me, please?
Sure. Chair McKay, through the chair, Representative Sadler, the fund is established in ADA.
Okay.
Representative Sadler, follow-up?
I would suggest a change in the analysis of the fiscal note provided by AEA, just because it says ADA.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that fiscal note should be removed once the bill's out of the committee. It's just the original version of the bill that was introduced, the AEA did have the fund under it as well.
Thank you very much. Through the chair, second question, I want to, for simplicity's sake, lay out how I see this bill's functioning. First, it creates the Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending Fund in ADA, and then there's no funding mechanism. It's up to the legislature to capitalize that with some kind of appropriation. And then ADA then would then lend money to finance investment production. The collateral is an oil and gas lease from the state, or is it undeveloped oil and gas resources? Do I have that right? And what is the collateral? How does that operate?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is a form of collateral that ADA can take. The bill doesn't limit ADA to only taking that type of collateral in an overall financing structure. So it does create this new tool, but it's not saying in structuring a financing agreement, you're limited to just this.
Okay, very good.
So we maintain our general authority, but this is a specific tool that would be helpful.
Okay. And I would certainly look forward to hearing from Mark Davis about some of the financing intricacies and how that might work. And my third question, with your indulgence,
Representative Sadler,
the first section of the bill, I think, talks about the obligations of the ADA dividend and says that between 25% and 50% of the value of this reserve-based lending fund would be asked of that fund to help pay the ADA dividend. Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, you do understand that correctly. That's a conforming amendment, basically, to conform any returns from loans made through this program to the SETS and the AIDF program and some of our other funds, all of which return a specific amount of between 25% to 50% of the net.
And clarify,
Representative.
And that's of the net income of the fund, not the value of the fund.
Correct.
Important distinction. Great. Sorry. Gotcha. Thank you very much.
Chair. Yeah, sorry.
I think there was one of those questions directed to Mark Davis. Mark, are you on the line now?
Yes, I am.
Ah, okay. Mark, Rep. Sadler, could you restate your question for the council? Or
Thank you, Chair, to Mr. Davis. I guess I just was trying to understand how the you're a finance guy, how the collateralization would happen and how the loans would happen in simple language, if you would, please. Mark.
Yes. Well, for the record, my name is Mark Davis. I'm counsel to ADA and Representative Sadler through the chair. The idea of reserve-based lending is that part of the collateral for the loan, not all the collateral, we take other collateral, is based upon the reserve value established about what the well has as its reserve, and that can be taken as the collateral that can later be monetized if need be.
And so that's one part of collateral, Director, or Mr. Raro said there were other kinds of collateral, but might that be just the other assets of a company that might want to take a loan out to drill and Cook Inlet? What other kinds of collateral?
Representative says, through the chair, you're exactly right. That is, to be careful, we would want to look at if the company owned the drilling rig, whether that could be collateral, whether they have other forms of assets that could be also taken as collateral, which might be other reserves they have or other leases. So obviously, we want to make sure we can get paid back if there's a problem.
Okay, very good. Thanks so much.
Okay, Representative Mears had a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm grateful you're here, Mr. Guerrero. Looking at the loans, it's my understanding that these are potentially significantly large loans compared to the other loans that ADA is doing, and we're looking at the legislator directing them at a rate that's below the floor for the other loans. How I might have had some of this wrong, but how would large loans at interest rates below the floor that ADA usually gets interest rates at affect the larger program of ADA and the ability to support other projects in the state?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, my understanding of the bill is that language no longer requires a below interest rate. It's discretionary to ADA. So we would look at all the risks, all the returns involved, and reach a decision, individual decision on each application. We're not required to charge a below market rate.
Representative Mears, through the chair, and Mark Davis, if he's on the line, he has a good explanation of this, because IGU was actually started under a similar loan, I believe. Mark, did you want to explain IGU a little bit?
And Mr. Davis, through the chair?
Yes. The IGU loan was in the uncodified section of a bill, HB 105, passed in 2015 by the legislature. And the legislature can direct ADA to make a loan, and it did so at a lower than market rate and conditions. But the present bill doesn't do that. So what the executive director noted was that this bill gives us the discretion to look at the reserves as a form of collateral rather than just the cash flows. And sometimes in a startup situation, the cash flows may be less than the value of the company. So this lets us value that part of the company, the reserves, in order to create a capital stack of collateral that will make us make the loan securely.
Okay. Thank you for the explanation, Mr. Davis. Representative McCabe has a question.
Thanks. Mr. Raro, I have a vague recollection of ADA paying money back to the state general fund last year. Was that $11 million, I think?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the chance to probe this. I'm not sure who's the best person to ask, but can you help me get some idea of what the size of these loans might be? I know that the loan is as big as you make it, but what would be maybe a minimum amount of money that might that this kind of loan fund might provide loans for? We're looking at $10, $20, $30 million dollars. I'm not quite sure who could answer, but just give me some idea of the size and scope of the loans.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know that there's a minimum amount or a maximum amount. We work with producers in the inlet that are very small, like Amarok, to the producers that are much larger. So I don't think there's a floor and a ceiling, set out in the bill.
Maybe the best answer, Director Raro, would be, what's the biggest oil and gas loan that ADA has ever made? Do you know?
To the chair, I think we would be looking at probably the Mustang investment, which was around $90 million.
$90 million.
Hex, I think, recently was $40 million. I'm not aware of anything above that, but Mark has much more institutional knowledge than I have.
This is Mr. Davis again, Representative Sadler, through the chair. Good question. I think another way to look at this is, what is the cost of drilling a well in Cook Inlet? And the last time that ADA did that with the Endeavor rig, the average cost of each well was $20 million. So that these loans will probably be in the range, as Mr. Raro said, of $20 million going up to a more comprehensive number, such as we did with HEX, where you've got other things just in the drilling platform.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, just to add a little bit of context on a cap, if the fund were to fund, say, a new platform in Cook Inlet, you'd be looking at $500 million, so roughly half billion for a cap. But I don't think ADA would want to be the sole funder, nor would they have to be the sole funder for a loan of that size. But let Director Raro speak more on how they delineate and work with other financiers.
Through the chair, that's a good point. We often are not the only financing entity involved in an arrangement, so the risk can be shared several times.
Okay.
Yeah, I can give this, Mr. Davis, another example. The Endeavor rig several years ago cost $144 million. ADA's investment in that rig was $23 million. So we had other partners.
Rep. McCabe.
Thanks. So I need to flesh this out a little bit. So you paid the state back last year $11 million into the general fund. So not only is ADA doing a service, providing a service for people that may want to explore for our well, but you're loaning them money, and then the return, you're just like a bank. The return comes back and eventually somehow finds its way back to the state of Alaska. So you're almost like our state bank, and you are. So we are also earning money off of what you are doing, essentially.
To the chair, Representative McCabe, that's correct. ADA's paid back the state or provided dividends of roughly $500 million since its existence. And that's just a share of the net income. We retain part of the net income to keep performing our other functions.
Thanks.
Okay, we're almost out of time. I just want to make one final comment, and that is, we're trying to think of everything we can do to help Cook Inlet outside of setting up our own oil company.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if Mr. Weraro would like to run an oil company out of ADA, but you're trying to do everything we can and still use the private sector who knows how to do this work. So I kind of wanted to give everybody that context. We're trying to do everything we can without having basically a state-run oil company to go out and drill for gas. So we're almost out of time. We are out of time. Are there any final burning questions? Representative Mears.
I'm sorry.
You sandbagged me right to the end.
No, you just didn't see me there earlier. I apologize through the chair, and hopefully this is a quick question. If not, we'll continue offline. Is the establishment of this loan program unique in a way that we wouldn't be able to issue these types of loans through existing programs in ADA?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, ADA has existing very broad discretion, but the details and the specificity provided in this bill help sharpen the tool in the toolbox, so to speak. It's not uncommon for the legislature to provide ADA with specific tools, although we have broad organic authority. So I believe the answer to your question would be, could we do this type of thing without the bill? I think the answer would be legally yes. Is it helpful to have the bill to provide some definition and details to ADA? And I think the answer would be yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weraro. I'll set an amendment deadline of Thursday, April 5th at 4 p.m. for House Bill 388, and we'll now set the bill aside. And I want to thank the committee very much. It's a lot of heavy work today. Thank you very sincerely for all your help. And thank you for everyone that was on the line. And I will adjourn us at 3 o'clock.